Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hey, we're posting a special edition of the podcast, a pre-Oscar edition of the podcast. That's because we happen to get a great booking here on the show. Billy Crudup agreed to come on, and Billy's a phenomenal actor. You probably know him from Almost Famous, but he's also in two of the movies that are on the best of the year lists and have been feted during the awards season this year. He was in Jackie and also in 20th Century Women. 20th Century Women, I believe, is up for best screenplay on Sunday night. So we're posting this now, and I got to tell you, this guy is an absolute pleasure to sit with, and as you'll hear, at least for me, completely different from what I expected. So here we go. Here's Billy Crudup. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. So many things I want to talk to you about, because you're in two of the movies that are getting talked about a lot during the award season this year, 20th Century Women and also Jackie. I've seen both of them. And last night, just to prepare for this, I also watched the first half of Almost Famous, which is amazing. But also, you're a meditator. So let's just start there for a second.
Okay.
How, when, where, why did you start meditating?
Well, you know, I'm sure you have the same reaction or have had a similar reaction before if somebody calls you a meditator. If you came to it as an adult, which is, no, I'm not. Mm. Like, I try, you know. I mean, mostly it's like it became a kind of triage situation for me, which is similar, I think, which was similar to some of the experiences that I read about in your book, where all the tools that you had arrived at your successful adulthood with were suddenly not supporting your experience of living responsibly and happily in your adult life. And I can remember when I was a kid. Also, by the way, I'm sure this will be a very fractured way of speaking the entire time, because when I was asked to come on and do this, immediately I thought of like a million things that I wanted to say and talk about, because these are normally conversations that I only have with my friends. And I guess that's for two reasons. One, when I speak publicly, I try to keep kind of an opaque reference or opaque version of myself out there, because my job is to create the illusion that I'm somebody else.
Yeah.
And I'm not really great at it anyway, and I don't want to put any more obstacles in the way of me succeeding in that. So I don't want to have a public persona that people know a lot about me. It seems like that is a counterintuitive idea to being an actor. It's not in terms of being famous and a celebrity, and people kind of conflate the two often, so it's a confusing situation. But this was the first situation where I thought, actually, I really do want to go and talk to Dan about this, because we also have a lot of mutual friends. But mindfulness is something that I've arrived at, or has been circling around my mind, or I've been circling it for a little while now. And I like talking about it and thinking about it and taking stabs at it and getting it wrong and practicing it and failing and all of that stuff that goes with it. But I remember when I was probably 9 or 10, my dad, who loved the ocean, wanted to take us deep sea fishing. We were in North Carolina spending the summer with him. And I had never been deep sea fishing. And you have to go about 2 hours off the coast of North Carolina to get to the deep water. And I had always imagined, I guess, that once you got past the breakers, it was calm out there. And I was deeply disappointed and incredibly nauseous when I discovered that the swells continue throughout the entire ocean and forever. And that's sort of how I felt when I arrived at my adult life, is I expected to then, I had all the trappings of success and adulthood. I had responsibility, I had artistic agency, I had money, I had friends. I was in relationships, and my family, you know, was close to me and supported me. But there was an underlying sense of dis-ease, and that was confusing to me. And so I, you know, began to reach out and talk to people about it. And I guess one of the things that kept coming up was this idea of mindfulness. Yeah.
You did this thing that I love when guests do, which is you said about 45 things that I want to follow up on. I don't even know where to start.
Good. Well, let's end it there then.
Nope.
Lovely.
Nope.
Okay.
You're not off the hook. Okay. So the one thing you said immediately jumps out at me is this idea of creating sort of an opaque personality, and that there's a difference between folks who are famous for being famous, celebrities, and folks who are, you know, real character actors and make their living and not just for money, but really it's their art form to have people project onto them when they're on the screen all of your own stuff, right? I'm not seeing you and thinking about all the stuff in your personal life. I'm seeing you and thinking about you only as a character. And I will say that the minute I met you, which was 10 minutes ago, I was already surprised. I expected you to be completely different. Because, you know, I just watch you in Jackie, in which you're a really tough-nosed reporter, hard-nosed reporter. Tough-nosed is probably not an expression.
Well, that's fine with me, because I'm going to use a lot of non-expressions during this interview.
Good. You have full license to do that.
Inventing all sorts of stuff right out of my butt.
This is a safe place.
Okay.
So anyway, you've succeeded, is I guess my point, and it's a really interesting strategy. And there are not many other public figures I can think of who've pursued that strategy. Only one name comes to mind, and I'm not even sure I'm right about this, but I think Matt Damon has kind of done that a little bit too.
Well, he's an actor that I admire immensely, and he's found a way to do both pretty convincingly and charmingly. I guess my experience, and ridiculously successfully, you know, it's tough to do either of those well for a long time, so to sort of do both of them. I mean, if you've watched his stuff on Kimmel, he has a spectacular kind of persona there that has been, they've been engaged in this dialogue for a long time that's really hilarious. But when I was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had an expectation that because I got into school there, and the only reason I got into school there, I think, was because my dad went there and my granddad went there. I wasn't a good enough student to get in there from out of state without some help. And so I felt a burden of responsibility that I better not screw up this privilege. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ways that I was born into privilege. And that kind of responsibility is actually something that I wanted to talk about in terms of mindfulness as you get older. I've read about, you said last night you watched half of Almost Famous, and I've read about a third of your book, 10% Happier, and I'm only 1% happier, so I hope it picks up steam.
It does.
Okay,
it does.
Good. But you talked about the sense of responsibility and that thing that your dad...
The price of security is insecure.
Insecure.
Yes, yeah.
And I mean, I would have expressed it maybe a little differently. My grandfather was always like, you know, don't get a big head or don't, you know, just keep your nose down. And if you are successful at something, just keep trying harder and never take yourself too seriously, but never stop working hard. You know, there was never a sense of you're doing great. You know, whatever you end up doing is good enough. I have an expectation that you'll want to succeed in the world. And so don't put that pressure. That's not the way that I experienced life at all. And so when I was in college and I couldn't figure out what to do, I kept getting really positive feedback about performances. And I was only doing plays after school and taking performance classes as a sort of slide class, you know, like things that I enjoyed. I needed the attention, I guess, or it was a way that I felt useful. People seemed to keep encouraging me to do that. I think that you mentioned something else like that in your book, is you end up doing one of the things that people keep encouraging, if you're lucky. People keep encouraging you to do it. And I had some very encouraging teachers who said, no, you should keep performing. And when I finally finished undergraduate, which was a semester late because I realized my junior year that I really didn't know what I was going to do, and I started taking like 9 hours a semester, kind of got to the end of it and was like, Dad, I guess I'm going to have to go an extra semester because I really, I didn't plan this well. And I needed the time really, I think, to figure out what I wanted to do. And so back to your point about how I thought about my job as an actor, I decided to go to graduate school. And I thought I would at the very least take it seriously and get a master's. And so many of the people that I admired were teachers. And I thought, what I'll probably end up doing is teaching because I love performance. I feel engaged by it. And I've admired so many of my teachers. And the first day of graduate school, I realized that I wasn't interested in teaching in the same way. I was actually really interested in performing, but I needed to be around people who were serious-minded about it and were really interested in whatever this craft was. You know, however we got there, whether it was through insecurity or neediness or attention-seeking, all of that, however we arrived at that moment when we were in our early 20s and we're going to take a stab at it, there was, you know, a group of us that were willing to go $80,000 in debt and take out student loans and study the craft and begin to imagine ourselves as craftspeople. And once I started getting opportunities, and I got opportunities almost right away, I felt a huge burden to take them seriously and to take the craft seriously. And that was a part of, I think, the invention for me of that kind of ideology, which is to try to fly below the radar as much as possible so that I can be the most useful at my job, which is to try and tell somebody else's story. That's when I feel particularly useful. I'm not inventing my own story. I remember Matt Damon actually said to me one time when I was sort of lamenting the fact that I couldn't find a job that was really inspiring to me at a certain period. Every actor goes through that about every 3 months. And actually most actors go through that their entire life. You know, it's an impossible profession for most people who try it. He said, why don't you write something? And I just wanted to say, dude, I'm going to kill you. The first thing you wrote, you got an Oscar for. Okay. I don't know how to write. I don't have any, why don't you just start welding or something? And be like, the reason I go to people like Tom Stoppard and, you know, classics and plays and stuff is because I want to be a part of storytelling that's much more interesting than anything I could have to offer. The best that I can offer is to be a part of that system. And the way to do that is to blend into that storytelling. And hopefully that comes about through kind of, you know, suppressing your own behavior in a way that you can surprise people by being... You always want people to imagine that's the only role you could have ever played. So I guess, you know, I mean, I certainly have a publicist who thinks that idea is terrible. And but it's quite interesting to come and talk about something that's different than my career or my approach to acting or the actual project that I'm working on, because it does reveal something
right
about me. But I guess, you know, part of it is I feel a little further along in my career. And this is also a kind of selfish endeavor for me, except for the fact that I've been the one talking the entire time, which is I'm really interested in how you've come to this, and the people that you've spoken to and the people that we sort of have in common have been inspirational to me in terms of navigating the middle of my life. So I feel kind of privileged to get an opportunity to have a dialogue about that.
Well, that's amazing. Thank you. I'm again at a fork in the road. Fork in the road where you just say too many things that are interesting. I guess one of the things I want to pick up on that I think is a really cool and brave admission is that you can seemingly have everything, right? You said you're a little further on in your career. I mean, dude, you arrived a long time ago, and you have everything that most people in this society aspire to, and yet there's still chop.
Yeah.
So and
exactly.
How is that true, and how has mindfulness helped with that?
Well, I think it's true because one of the things that you allude to is the experience of constantly thinking about the past or the historical parts of your own story and imagining the future when you will have solved the aspects of your history that haunt you and you will thrive in your future time. Strong, maybe I would be even a little taller. I don't know. All the things that I imagine are going to happen.
Just for the record, according to your Wikipedia page, you're an inch taller than me. So in this room, you're the tallest dude.
I wore my lifts today, too.
Good.
I kept one of my good friends is a director named Bart Freundlich. And I would often lament to him during times of despair or just like listlessness. I keep waiting for my excellent life to start. Because when you have more privilege than you think is fair, really, and you have more success than so many of your peers and so many opportunities. Most people get like one great role in their life. And I've had multiple opportunities on stage and in movies with phenomenal roles. And that's a real rare thing. And I guess I kept thinking that the pressure and responsibility that I felt, that was the insecurity is the price of for security, was going to dissipate as I arrived into the calm of the ocean. And it didn't. It in fact increased. And then there are other responsibilities that happen in your adult life, and those add to the pressures. And whether you have success or failure in those, they kind of start to pile on and weigh you down. And without new tools to navigate them, you're stuck with the same systems that you grew up with. And I grew up in, like I'm sure many people who are listening, an American system of capitalist ambition, you know, that, and it's not that, I don't mean that in a pejorative way, it's just a way of thinking, which is that, you know, you keep striving, you try to make the most of your opportunities, you don't take things for granted, you help people who are less fortunate than you are. There's not a sense of coasting in my idea of like success. It's like grit and constant work. And at a certain point, I tried to explain to somebody, maybe it was myself, but I was trying to explain the idea of arriving at a life that you thought was what you had planned for and not really knowing how to navigate it. Being a public figure is a very different thing than being a storyteller. Having a responsibility as a parent is unlike anything you could have predicted. Trying to be a responsible citizen when you depended upon people that you admired to do that before, to be one of those people is a different kind of pressure. So I think all of those things, a confluence of those things, led me to start feeling that level of anxiety in a pretty significant way. And I experienced it in a similar way to you with panic attacks, navigating those on stage.
Oh, you were having them on stage?
I have had some pretty interesting experiences with respect to anxiety and performance. Not performance anxiety, okay? I just want to make that clear. Anxiety and performance. Well, there goes this interview.
No. This interview is going swimmingly. Innuendo is totally fine here.
So one of the first times I experienced anxiety, I was doing a mold for my face for something. And they pour all this latex over your face. And
yes,
they give you a couple of...
That sounds horrible.
I have never had any kind of claustrophobia. You know, I kind of... always counted myself as somebody game for whatever. I'll try something once. I might not like it. I might not be good at it. But I had two brothers growing up, and I don't allow myself to be intimidated very often about trying something, you know, like even if it goes very, very badly. But so I had this latex on my face, and the guy who was in charge of it said, okay, so I'm going to say, are you okay? And you give me the thumbs up if you're okay, and give me the thumbs down if you're not. And I was kind of like, all right, whatever, man. I'm just do the latex thing. You don't have to worry about me. And he, midway through, he's like, are you okay? And I'm like, you know, your eyes are closed in the way that... Then he said, are you okay? Give him the thumbs up. A couple more minutes went by. And this is probably like a 15-minute process or so. He said, are you okay? At that point, I started to get a little angry. Yeah. I was like, why do you keep asking me that? You know, like, yes, that's a thumbs up again. And then he's like, the fourth time, he's like, are you okay? And I'm kind of like, and all of a sudden my heart pounds out of my chest. I can't breathe. I feel, I never had this feeling before, you know, where you want to run. And I just put my thumb down, and like, they immediately peeled the latex off my face, which felt like it had the consistency of a tissue. I mean, it was nothing. It was not the oppressive weight that I was experiencing in my chest. And I just turned to him and I was embarrassed as hell. And I was like, I don't know what happened. I just started breathing. He's like, it's fine. That happens sometimes. I was like, yeah, it's really strange. Can you just give me like 10 seconds and then let's do it again, because I am not going to let that intimidate me. And I did it again. And it was the longest 15 minutes of my life, just trying to keep it together. And if you've had panic attacks, then you become aware of something called anticipatory anxiety. Yep. And so there's this cycle that starts.
Yeah, once you learn how to panic, you get really good at it. It's unfortunate.
Your body, and it is a, your, yeah, you break through in a way. And I so identified with that part of your book.
And then it started happening to you on stage?
So then I can remember the first time it happened to me on stage. Well, I may be getting the order wrong. I believe it's happened to me three times on stage. Once I was doing a play called The Metal Children, which was off-Broadway at the Vineyard Theater. And it was a play by Adam Rapp. And I had a monologue at a podium. And, oh, that must have been the second time. Because the first time, I'm sure of it now, was during Coast of Utopia, which was a Tom Stoppard trilogy. It was like three plays about Russian philosophy, turn of the century. And I had a monologue during that one. And midway through the monologue, I went up. And going up is what actors say when you, for the term for losing your lines. So during a monologue, there aren't other people to help you, especially if like the end of the monologue is a really big thematic part of the story. And I'd worked enough in the theater that you go up a little bit sometimes, but what feels like an hour for you is a millisecond. The audience never sees it. And so the typically the best thing to do is take a breath, actually like step back from where you are, look at the person in front of you. And usually because of rehearsal, because you've worked hard, it comes. But this one, like I stepped back, I took a breath, and watching the actors who were on stage with me at that time go from pretend listening to real listening because they knew something was up. I mean, I usually flew through this monologue. And so to have a break like that, so then I saw them looking at me. Then I could hear my breath.
Oh, I'm freaking out hearing this story.
And then I started to have a panic attack. Oh. And I just sat down, actually, during my monologue, took some more breaths, kind of, and started to watch my mouth say the words. And I was kind of having an out-of-body experience. But it was really the next day that was the biggest problem, because it's such an uncomfortable experience. And I took the approach that I took with everything before that, the approach that I took the first time I had the panic attack with the latex, which is I'm just going to muscle through this. And yeah, that's just no bueno for very long. Mm-hmm. So I had to start, you know, figuring out some other ways to get some help. Mark Epstein was a big help. He was a mutual friend through someone. I went and saw him. He's a therapist.
Dr. Mark Epstein, who is a friend of mine, and I guess your doctor. And he's written all these amazing books about the overlap between psychology and Buddhism. And he's the reason I got into meditation and Buddhism.
Yeah, and a big influence for me too, for sure. Certainly the way that he talks about mindfulness and processing your own history. And I think it was during the next time that I had a panic attack, which was during The Metal Children, he prescribed a beta blocker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a funny thing.
It's like magic, beta blocker.
It is.
Let me just explain what it is, so people know. It's for high blood pressure, and it but everybody from concert pianists to surgeons to anybody who's speaking in public to actors, news anchors, you can take them, and it will prevent you from having the physiological impact of a panic attack. It basically, your heart rate cannot go above a certain level. So you can have the psychological parts of the panic, but your body won't mutiny the way it does when you're not on one.
Mutiny is a perfect word for it, because when you know that your body is not going to become hysterical in that way. It's easier to manage the psychological parts of it. And that anticipatory anxiety becomes a lot less diminished and stuff. But then once you get past those actual moments, once the play ends and you don't have to go out there anymore, you're not having as much anticipatory anxiety or whatever, then the opportunity arrives to observe what brought you to that moment in the first place. How is it that I had done or have done, I don't know how many plays that I've done in New York, with a lot of pressure on many of them, some very difficult performances. I can remember doing a play with Frances McDormand one time that was almost 4 hours long. And I went up so bad during that because the dialogue was really repetitive and difficult that at a certain point we had a two-person scene. I kept circling back to something in the beginning and got us into a loop. And at a certain point she just stopped and looked at me and said, I don't know what we're saying anymore, so I'm just going to say this. And I looked at her like a puppy, like, thank you for getting me out of there. So I had navigated situations like that, you know, throughout. That's just part of performing. But I had never had that level of anxiety where I couldn't cope with it. I think that was the inspiration for me kind of to start considering the way that my mind works.
Was that when you got into meditation, or you had already tasted it?
I was first introduced to it by my son's mom when we were together. Mary Louise was teaching.
Mary Louise Parker. Formerly of Weeds.
Yep. She was teaching yoga at the time, too. And it's funny, the first time that she taught me meditation, I approached it the way that I guess I approach everything, which is with rabid competitive antagonism.
Yes, absolutely. I love it.
It's just the way that, and I just wanted to be great at it. And when after five,
how'd that go for you?
Great, actually, terrific. Because I think I don't know if it was like 5 or 10 minutes, but afterwards she said, "Wow, you didn't even swallow during that," you know. And I was like, "Nailed it! Crushed that meditation. Don't ever want to do it again." Don't know what it was about, but at least I was still and impressed her. But I ever since the end of college, I have had an interest in, I guess, religion and the ways that I think about myself and the world. And I had a lot of different influences growing up. But I read The Road Less Traveled when I was, you know, like in college. And to me, that was really interesting to have an alternate perspective about how to manage relationships and your sense of self. And if you're an actor, you try to empathize with a lot of different kinds of people. So it's good to have an open mind and take in new ways of thinking. But it was really when I started to work with Mark and also my other friend, Elizabeth Cathrell.
Is the one who introduced us. And she produced Jesus'
Son.
That's
right. Yeah. Co-wrote, produced, acted in. She and I were in graduate school together.
Gotcha. And so that movie came out in like 1999, if I recall.
Yeah, yes. I think that's right. And she has been a major influence in my life in a myriad of ways. She's a great friend and a brilliant artist, but also somebody who has always been interested in mindfulness. And we'd always go and have lunch and stuff and talk about maybe doing some other project together. And she would say, you know, you should go talk to my friend Joseph Goldstein. You know, he's a really interesting, because I guess the ways that I would speak about the struggles that I was having with anxiety or the ways that I was thinking about, I don't want to say religion, but ideology or whatever, to her sounded familiar. And so she kept encouraging me to pursue that. And I always be like, nah, I don't have time for that. It sounds great, but, then she introduced me to Joseph Goldstein once at her house. And the first time I met this guy, the sort of gravity around him, I burst into tears.
Really?
It doesn't take much for me to burst into tears, Dan. It's kind of my job. Like it's another interesting thing about being an actor is you have to be really thin skinned if you want to be, well, the kind of actor I like being is really thin-skinned when you're working. You're very available to the other actors. So there's what I would describe as something called immediacy in your work. It appears as though it's happening for the first time. But then you have to be really thick-skinned when it comes out and people tell you that you're a piece of bleep, you know? Or worse, nobody sees it, nobody gives a crap, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a very strange experience.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
So can I just jump in and just explain some of these characters? So you really hacked into like the Buddhist mafia on the East Coast, because so Elizabeth Cuthrell is, as we mentioned, she's a film producer. She's close with Dr. Mark Epstein, who you who became your shrink after you had the panic attacks, and then Joseph Goldstein. So this is another name that you mentioned. She's incredibly close with Joseph. Joseph is, you know, has been kind of semi-facetiously referred to as the Pope of American Buddhism. He's just this eminent meditation teacher, and was really a pioneer who helped bring meditation to the United States back in the 60s and 70s. He also is my meditation teacher and is all over my book, and he's the guiding teacher on the 10% Happier app. I mean, I'm extremely close with Joseph. So anyway, just so that everybody has the background, you meet this guy and you end up bursting into tears?
Well, I was going through a particularly difficult time, and the way that I, you know, managed that was a lot of, like, grit, you know, like just keep it down, you know, or find ways to think it through or solve it somehow, you know. The idea of just existing with it, I can remember Mark saying at some point, I think I said, you know, man, if this anxiety keeps up like this, I don't know if I can handle it, you know. And he was like, yes, you can. And I was like, but my whole life? And he's like, yes. And I was like, no, please, no. But I apparently at that time was under a lot of stress, and Elizabeth is always like incredibly encouraging, and would kind of diminish, like, the way that you just described him is the way that he exists in the world, but the way that she would describe him to me would be like, please meet my friend Joseph, you know, he's a lovely person, a brilliant thinker, and I think you two would really get along. And as soon as I met him, there was a kind of gravity to his presence. And I don't mean to sound what's the word, Pollyanna-ish something. I told you I was going to be inventing stuff.
Let's go with that.
Okay. But he was looking right at me, and there was no hiding for me. I've got lots of social skills to deflect and to manage awkward situations, and you learn that as an actor, you know, and probably one of the reasons I am an actor, and I moved around a lot as a kid, so I know how to socially get through some awkward situations. This one, when that kind of presence, it just opened me right up. Like, he was where he was, so I had to be where I was, which was a mess, you know, at that time. And his reception of that was also so, like, empathetic and compassionate that I think that was moving to me in a different way, too. And Mark is kind of like that, you know. Not kind of, Mark is like that as well. And so those experiences, I think, allowed me to imagine different practice, applying different practices to my life that might make things a little bit better, as you say in your book.
Yeah.
But I also, I'm talking the entire time.
Yeah, that's the point of you being interviewed.
Okay.
As far as I understand it.
I know none of my friends are listening to this because this is what they hear all the time, but they will have shut this off a while ago for sure. So But I find it so fascinating. But I thought of this with respect to your book, 10% Happier. For me, it wasn't just the idea of being a little bit, feeling a little bit better. It's the fact that the tools that I had and the mind that my mind in motion as an adult was actually taking me down. So it wasn't as though there was this plateau I had reached that I could be a little happier. I was actually starting to feel worse and worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, you were at a deficit.
So it's really like about 40% happier, that if that makes any sense.
No, I'm terrible at math. And so, I hate that I'm kind of stuck with this title that I pulled out of my rear end. But you're absolutely right. And this was one of the 45 things you said in your first answer that I wanted to follow up. Then you brought us right back to it, which is that the tools that you're bequeathed by the culture and by your own idiosyncrasies that bring you to whatever success you achieve or whatever point you're at in your middle life don't serve you anymore at some point. They're kind of serving you, but you're reaching diminishing returns in certain areas. And what meditation is useful for, in my experience, is to see where you're being an idiot and course correct a little bit, and then also see where nothing's to be done. Like, there's a certain amount of anxiety that is just part of your wiring or part of the conditions in which you exist in the world. And can you just be with it in a way that doesn't make it worse? It doesn't add. There's a great little parable in Buddhism that I'm sure you've heard, which is the second arrow. Dude's walking through the forest. He gets hit by an arrow. That sucks, right? But you add on to the pain of the first arrow with a second arrow that you insert voluntarily, which is, why am I always the guy getting hit by the arrow? Right. Who did that? I'm going to find them. You know, I'm not going to make lunch now because I got hit by this arrow, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
The second, that sort of optional suffering that we layer on to the baked in pain of existence. Meditation is just good for managing all of that stuff.
That's my experience as well. And when you asked me before, when you said before that I meditate, and I kind of bristled at that, I think part of it is because as you are like in your infancy and understanding your mind, you realize the constant ways in which your mind leads you down crappy paths. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, you actually, the more mindful you become at the beginning, the worse you feel about your own capability. Because I had such smart influences, they never led me down the path that I was meditating to calm my mind. It was always the analogy of, you're just going to go sit in the corner and watch the party going on. The second arrow reminds me also too of the, you're not responsible for your first thought, you're responsible for your second
thought.
That's
right.
That gets at a very weird idea for me, which is, I grew up hearing a lot about my gut and go with your gut, follow your heart, your instincts are always right. And you know, I've come to believe that that's not probably as useful as it sounds. Many of the things that feel instinctual and that feel like gut reactions are responses to things that happened to you before you were probably even conscious. Mm-hmm. You know, like before you could speak, well before you can remember.
Or they're wired into your lizard brain and you inherited them from, you know.
Exactly.
Thousands of years of evolution.
Exactly. And so having to let go of that idea that your gut might actually lead you in a direction that's not helpful for you sometimes has been an interesting exercise.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I've thought about this too and I don't have it figured out. But you know that Malcolm Gladwell book, Blink? About the wisdom of the subconscious, that the decisions we make in the blink of an eye, et cetera, are sometimes the smart one. I feel like I'm the anti-blink. Like my gut instinct is always like the dumbest thing. Like I'm ready to do the dumbest thing on first
blush. I have that experience too. I'll tell you where it's useful is creativity. It's really useful in making creative choices. Because what it allows you to do is identify what's singular about you without intellectualizing it. You can make choices, you know, you can always invent things using your rational mind, but sometimes you can surprise yourself and surprise others by making creative choices that just, where you're, we call it enacting, like getting out of your own way.
Yeah.
That's where it is useful for me. It's not so useful for me when living in New York City, people don't follow my rules. I always talk about that, like with my brothers. Like, if everybody just cooperated with my rules, I wouldn't have such a hard time taking my son to school. I came up with this thing with my friend Bart to try to get out of that mindset, because it happens so fast. You know, that immediate response to somebody cutting you off, or somebody just driving in a way that makes me feel unsafe. And also, when you have a kid, when you feel unsafe, it makes them unsafe. I did not handle that well.
Oh, like, that's that. Talk about lizard brain. I mean, you're going to, I know that feeling having a kid. You just lose it. It's,
I would be giving people the finger.
Of course.
So that he couldn't see it back there in the back. You know, I'd be like,
but
nothing's happening, son.
This issue of the gut and like when it's wise and when it's not, I haven't figured this out. So I'm not going to be dropping a whole bunch of wisdom here, but just thinking, just kind of putting out word fog. I feel like meditation is useful here, maybe in that there's some sort of innate wisdom that you know when your gut's giving you, on some level, you know when your gut's giving you a good idea and when it's giving you a bad idea. It, for you as a performer, and for me as somebody who is, wants to be spontaneous in my podcast interviews or when I'm on the air, if you can get out of your own way, actually, if you can stop the useless chattering and listen to whatever intuition you have, actually, you can make better, more authentic decisions. By the same token, though, when you're in traffic and somebody cuts you off and you don't want to fall victim to the road rage that emerges right up from your brainstem, but there is, to me, in my experience, what meditation does is like a thin layer of wisdom right on top of this. So like when I'm getting a spontaneous idea, maybe even in a conversation with you where I'm trying to like be right here and play ping pong with you back and forth, it goes through the filter of mindfulness. And if it's a terrible idea, you know, like some percentage of the time I'll catch it. And the same thing when I'm feeling rage and I'm about to say the thing that's going to like ruin my marriage for the next 48 hours, I'll catch it some percentage of the time and not do it. But they're coming from the same kind of place, I think. Anyway, that was a word salad.
No, it actually got to something it reminded me of something Joseph Goldstein said, which I found infuriating because this was the way that I responded to acting school too, which was, I want the answers, man. Don't tell me that I haven't paid, you know, this much money to not get the key to acting. Okay. Don't tell me that it's a process, the lifelong process that I'm just like undertaking. And Joseph Goldstein had a similar kind of thing, he said, well, when it's useful, use it, you know, when this is useful to you. So it doesn't mean like cutting off your instinct to eat when you're hungry. That's
right.
Probably a good instinct.
Yes, yes.
But it's probably not as useful for me to try and teach somebody that I don't know how to drive the way I want them to by screaming at them. and it doesn't take long to kind of figure out that that's not a great strategy. So I think part of, for me, we would call it wisdom when people get older and they do, well, maybe you don't need to care about that.
Yeah.
You know? Or maybe this is something good to follow, is learning the ways in which your mind and your body helps you achieve the values, achieve putting into the world the values that you hold or that are things that are important to you, and trying to diminish a little bit the ways in which your mind and body encourage different values.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it is not, there's no formula. That's, that pisses me off too. There's no formula.
It's so wrong.
It is wrong. Formula. Yeah, but what are you going to do about it? Joseph's just the messenger. We can't kill him. but I do think is that there you... meditation helps you sort of get a cleaner signal to noise ratio so that when your instincts and urges and impulses and desires are arising, you're like better at picking out the good ones and rejecting the bad ones. And it's not going to be 100% of the time. It'll just be some.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, 100% of the time. I am terrible at this, by the way. I just want to add.
Anybody who says they're good at meditation, I think you should be very
dubious of.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm horrendous at it.
Good.
And my behavior reflects it. Like when I can catch myself, I count it as a complete triumph.
Yes, you should.
And it only comes from like a ton of work. So it's like a ton of work for a little bit of a payoff. But what I was doing what do they call it? Where a guided meditation.
Yeah.
And the woman said something to the effect of, "Hey man, give yourself a break just for coming in and meditating, because ultimately what you're trying to do is be more in the world. And that's probably a good thing. That's probably a generous, loving, empathetic, civically responsible, good thing. Just trying to be present." I can easily follow a different narrative in my head, which is that it's a selfish, that even me talking about it is a selfish, egotistic experience that is, you know, revolting at best. When you give yourself a little bit of a break about that, even trying to be mindful is a nice thing to be doing. It makes the effort worth it, I think, for me.
Absolutely. You know, I hear this a lot, the idea that somehow meditation is self-indulgent or navel-gazing. I think it's totally misguided. It's totally misguided. And Joseph talks about this a lot, too, that it's like the airline safety instructions. When the oxygen masks come down, they say put your own on first before you can help anybody, before you help or assist others, I think is the way they say it. You can't be useful or effective in the world if you're a complete mess. There's nothing you can do. So we're not talking about spending 23 hours a day meditating, just a few minutes a day so that you're more sane. And that's what you're contributing to the rest of the planet. That is definitely a public service.
Well, I agree. And because we're also not talking about becoming monks. What we're talking about is how do we live in an American society with the values that were given to us and that are encouraged by the, you know, socio-political system around us. How do we live in that society in a way that helps to mitigate some of our anxiety so that we can be productive? And that's not an easy task. You know, we haven't been encouraged in this culture to live in that way. Ambition is really the foundation of this culture. And we get a sense that to be a good American is to be an American who strives for something better than their parents had, or to create a life for yourself that is inspirational or something, or takes advantage of all the opportunities you've been given. That's sort of what I was talking about in terms of feeling that burden before, is I didn't often feel grateful first. I felt the burden first, you know, like, and I certainly didn't allow feelings of pride or even the acknowledgement that I was responsible for any of it for a long time, which is actually, I think, okay to fix into the mix. You know, there's a lot of ways to experience success and still have ambition without being rigid with anxiety.
And this is where I think, just getting back to the self-indulgence versus public service thing, that actually you're going to struggle with the things you struggle with, right? But you want to be in the process, like a good romantic partner. You want to be a good dad. You want to be good to your colleagues on the various productions in which you participate. And it can't, to me, an inexorable outgrowth of understanding how insane you are is that you have empathy for everybody else. You realize we're all crazy.
Right.
And that just makes you a better citizen. It just does.
I totally agree.
I don't think there's any two ways about it. I don't think there are two ways about it. That's there. I go mixing up, messing up an aphorism. Before we go, though, I want to talk about your son. You got a 13-year-old son. Let's give him a shout out. He's into meditation, right?
He is. Yeah, his mom introduced him to meditation and yoga, and he takes great pride in the fact that he's been able to meditate before, and so we try to do it sometimes together now, and he's had lots of practice with his mom. But we were talking yesterday because he and I were on vacation in Jamaica, and we were on the way back, and I was telling him about coming in here and what we were going to talk about and some of the things that I'd been thinking about. And I said, what are some of the things you think about, when you meditate? And he said, well, I try to think about a word, or I try to think about my breath, but sometimes it's really hard, my mind is really busy. And he asked about me, and I said, the breath is the thing that I try to go to too. And I had some teacher who told me at one point, your mind is going to drift away 1,000 times. Your job is just to bring it back 1,001. That's mm-hmm. it. Just bring it back to the breath. And Mark said something, because there was the idea that just watching your mind in motion, like watching the party, standing in the corner watching the party, and not getting drawn into mm-hmm. the party, for me was a way of just identifying the feelings, like so sadness or anger or whatever feelings were being generated. And Mark said something to the effect of, I just go like feeling. There's a feeling. There's a sound. There's a feeling. And I was continuing to think about that. And I think it was in Joseph's book, Heart Full of Peace, where he said something to the effect of, a feeling is being known. Mm-hmm. So not identifying with that as you being the one who generated. So I was explaining to Will, and I have kind of an empirical, I like science. To me, astronomy is one of my favorite things, and learning about astronomy was one of my favorite things as an adult. And I said to Will, I said, so I've got this new thing when I meditate, which is that like the universe is knowing sadness or something. Oof. Like you as an extension of the universe, because we're made up of molecules and stuff, and humans came about through evolution. So there is a way to describe this experience as just being the universe kind of knowing these things. And then, and in awesome 13-year-old fashion, he looks at me in the plane and goes, Dad. Yeah.
So you just scored the biggest touchdown a dad can ever score, which is your 13-year-old son thinks you're cool and smart.
Well, I'm not sure.
For a nanosecond, at least.
At least for a nanosecond, yeah.
I mean, I love that point. It's true. I mean, the point of meditation, or one of the points, is to see all the stuff in your head with some non-judgmental remove, so that when you're hit by it in real life, it doesn't own you.
Exactly.
When anger shows up, when the desire to eat 75 cookies shows up, you don't actually just get yanked around by it as much. But then there's a deeper level, which is like, okay, so what is aware of these emotions? What is aware of all of these thoughts? Once you've stepped out of the party, who is that person looking at everything else? And that's a huge mystical question.
It drives me nuts, too. And like when Mark
says... It's supposed to drive you nuts.
Yeah. And Mark will say things like, well, no one really. Or, it isn't being experienced, or something, abstract like that. I'd just be like, what am I?
But this
How
is
do a, you process that?
You don't... I mean, I think it's a useful... It's a kind of frustration, confusion. Now we're getting to deep end of the pool stuff here, but this is this confusion about who or what you are. Where, if you close your eyes and look for Billy, you're not going to find him, right? If you listen to sounds and then try to find what's hearing those sounds,
Thought without a thinker, right?
Yeah. Who is there, right? Who's there? This is the mystery of consciousness. This is the big one. And I think, as I understand it, there's a useful confusion that can be generated that over time kind of cools you out.
Right.
You said before that, there's a wisdom that emerges in old people, that they're a little less, some elderly people, that they're a little less caught up in everything. And one of my favorite meditation teachers is a younger guy named Jeff Warren, who's my age, 45, he's based in Toronto, and he talks about the fact that meditation is about bringing that wisdom of aging gracefully into the earlier part of your life.
Right.
And so that's what you're doing. You're basically just trying to generate some of this emotional agility around all of the crap in your own head, and then when you push it a little deeper, you're also trying to create this kind of useful confusion about who is this anyway? Who's in here anyway? And that can all just kind of cool you out.
Useful confusion is a fantastic term, I think. I don't have anything to add to that, surprisingly.
What an unbelievably pleasant surprise you are as a guest. This is so cool to sit here and talk to you, man.
Thanks, really appreciate it.
It
is absolutely my pleasure. It is. I am a fan of the thinking that is going on right now, and your encouragement of that, I think, is pretty rad.
Thank you. Anything that if our listeners want to know more about you, want to learn about what kind of works you've got coming up, where can we go?
Well, I hope that I won't give up any more secrets about who I am to anyone, but I will be in a movie called Alien Covenant coming out at some point soon, which was awesome to be a part of an alien movie with Ridley Scott and Michael Fassbender. And that was one of the first times Will was really excited about me being all the
this
movies.
Is your son.
Yeah, my son, Will. Most of the movies are like I'm sitting around adults talking about hard stuff. And he's like, yeah, Dad, that's what I want to see. So this is one where I get to, you know, run through stuff and be chased by aliens. And he was super fired up about that. So
I'm fired up too. I'm going to see it. I guarantee it. Billy, thank you very much.
Total pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're the best.
All right, man.
Really appreciate it. Okay, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please make sure to subscribe, rate us. And if you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. I also want to thank heartily the people who produce this podcast and really do pretty much all the work. Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.